Welcome to the Victory Show.
Hey, Victors, welcome to the Victory Show, where seven-figure founders, entrepreneurs, and executives reveal the real playbook behind scaling past that first million in recurring revenue. We go beyond the highlight reel into the hard lessons, the costly mistakes, the key growth inflection points, and the human decisions that shaped the numbers. And here's the twist. Every conversation we're having is becoming a chapter in our Victory Book series, so the next generation of builders doesn't have to start from scratch. Today's guest is a mission-first entrepreneur building companies that make health care work better for patients, for providers, and the system as a whole. John Montague is a serial entrepreneur based in Minneapolis, recognized with honors like the Minnesota Cup and the ACG Bold Award for his impact in business and innovation. He's partnered with leading institutions like the Mayo Clinic, developed scalable healthcare solutions, and most recently led a company through a successful acquisition by United Healthcare, his second with them. At every stage, John's focus has remained consistent: create real-world solutions that move the needle in healthcare and build businesses that matter. John, thanks so much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Travis. Good to be here.
So, were you always sort of entrepreneurial inclined, or did that sort of find you as you went through your journey in life?
I think I became an entrepreneur by default. You know, I was young, and my mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was, you know, not even out of grade school. And that had a huge toll on my family in every level, you know, and financially as well. All of a sudden we found ourselves kind of bankrupt, going through a lot of things with insurance and paying for treatments and things for my mother that the insurance wouldn't cover, et cetera. So, you know, I grew up in a pretty affluent part of Minneapolis as well. And so if I wanted those new shoes that all my friends had, if I wanted the nice new car when I turned 16, like all my friends had, if I wanted to, you know, go on trips and do all the things that my friends were doing on a regular basis, I had to learn how to pay for those things because my family was not in a position to do that. So, you know, I was the typical kid that started mowing lawns and babysitting and caddying at the local golf club and kind of doing everything I could to make money. And
so you had side hustles before side hustles were a thing.
Exactly. And I started a pretty meaningful business while I was still in high school by just, you know, the age old story of an entrepreneur is I think you see a problem and you fix it. I saw a problem in high school and I fixed it, and it turned into a nice little business.
So what was the problem?
The problem was that the kids I was going to school with had nothing to do socially. You know, you were going to house parties in someone's basement, or but there weren't the kind of opportunities to go out to a club or to hear live music or to do the kind of things that a lot of people wanted to do. So I started renting out different dance halls and things around the city and there were a lot of bands that were playing. I played in a band at the time myself, and you didn't have a place to play. Because if you weren't older, you couldn't play at all the music clubs that were, you know, alcoholic bars. So I just started renting out dance halls, hiring guys from our football team to work the door as security and take the door money. And I started hiring my band and the bands of kids I knew from other high schools in the area to be the, you know, the featured entertainment at these party concerts. And it turned into a great little business, you know, while I was in high school.
Wow. How many years did you do that?
For 2 years.
Over the course of 2 years,
I probably threw 10 to 12 of these parties, you know, maybe 5 or 6 a year.
Wow. So how much of your personal time did it take to find, or once you found the venue, were you then able to just keep going back, or would you try to mix it up?
You know, I laugh and I think about how easy it really was, and yet how much money that we were able to bring in. You know, and this was pre-internet in a lot of ways, definitely pre-social media. And
all word of mouth.
But yet, even back then, we understood the concept of target marketing because, you know, once we rented out the dance hall and we got 3 bands that would play, and we specifically would pick bands from different schools, so then we could market to their school. So we'd get the bands from 3 different schools. And then it was pretty easy. We would just make little flyers. And at lunchtime, we had an open campus. And so a friend and I would drive over to these high schools where the bands were going to play from. And we would just pepper all the cars in the parking lot with little flyers under their windshield. because we knew that our target audience were kids that had cars and that could drive and could get out to see a show, go to a party. But yeah, it was a fun experience. But that was my first entrepreneurial experience, and kind of gave me the confidence probably to continue on and do other things as an entrepreneur.
What a great start. Yeah. So did that from there, did you think, there's something with this business thing? Did you go to school specifically for business or?
No, I didn't. I went to school and I studied economics and political science. And at the time, I wanted to maybe get into the capital markets,
Wow.
or I maybe wanted to one day run, and be a senator. I very much idolized John Kennedy, and I
Wow.
kind of wanted to make a difference in the world somehow. And I thought maybe that was the path to do it. And then when I got out of school, I kind of followed my education and took a job in the capital markets and worked in that world for a few years. But I just kept having the entrepreneurial kind of calling. And so about probably 4 or 5 years after I got out of school, that's when I had my first opportunity to do something bigger, on an entrepreneurial level.
So walk me through that. What was that first experience?
Well, it was interesting because I told you I was working in the capital markets, and I was actually working at Paine Webber, and I was on the sell side at Paine Webber. I had been on the buy side at Cargill. I'm working in the financial markets division at Cargill.
Wow.
Got hired out of there to go to the sell side working at Paine Webber, and we merged with Kidder Peabody. And I mentioned that my mother, had a disease when I was younger. MS. Well, she was still alive then, and I was spending a lot of my time caring for her when I wasn't working. And I had made an arrangement that I could work in our hometown of Wayzata in one of the retail offices of Paine Webber, but I was working as part of the institutional sales team there out of New York. And we merged with Kidder Peabody, and the new boss that I had came in, and he said, I got bad news, and I got bad news. First part of bad news is a lot of the clients that you've built and are covering today, you're going to lose because you're junior to the senior guys here that are covering those same accounts. And number two, if you're going to keep working as part of this team, I need you to move to New York. And there really were no options to stay. And so there was a company that had gone public and burned through a lot of its cash. And but I knew the principals at that business pretty well. And when they found out my situation, they said, "Hey, we've got a great idea. Why don't you come on board as our investment officer? Why don't you come on board and basically handle all the communications with our shareholders,
Wow.
and be our investor relations guy? You've got the background for that." And then over time, I quickly was handed the marketing leadership job. And then shortly after that, I was given the sales leadership job just as we built the business. And it was a what I would call a start around, in that we took a business that had burned through all of its capital and wasn't getting any traction, and we basically sold off. It was a classic tech company that had technology that was just out on the bleeding edge and way ahead of, the demand in the market. And so we sold that technology off. We took the consulting business that was one part of the business that was actually bringing in some money, and we built the whole business from the consulting
Wow.
practice and focused on a whole new area of technology. And so it was like a start around. It wasn't a pure startup, but it was a turnaround that we took from, at the time, maybe less than $1 million in revenue and a team of six, to eight, to 3, 4 years later, 500 plus employees, 100 million
Wow.
in revenue,
Wow.
kind of a rocket ship.
So you said something interesting that, on my end, we always hear about, especially bigger corporations, the marketing and the sales are always fighting with each other. So there's a marketing problem, it's a sales problem. So you had a chance to work on both. So can you talk to that a little bit? What did you learn marketing? What did you learn to sales? And what did you learn about the communication between those two?
Well, it's funny because that lesson that I learned then, and the way that I was given a leadership role over both organizations within our company, that's been something that stuck with me throughout my entire career. And it's kind of what I've become known for, is that, I walk into a lot of meetings and I say, I'm all about S&M. Everybody looks at me cross-eyed, and then I explain I'm talking about sales and marketing, and the fact that I think a lot of companies are, they make a fundamental error in the way that they build the structure of their business, and that those two parts of the company are two separate disciplines. They're separate departments. And like you said, a lot of times they're even working on separate strategies and plans. And when it doesn't work, what happens?
Meet
Well,
each other.
sales points at marketing and says, we had a bad plan. We don't have good materials. We,
The
you know,
leads
and
suck.
marketing points at sales and says, no, we had it all right. You know, we've got a clear value proposition. We know who our customer is, and we've given them great materials and plans and strategies, but these guys are just too stupid to be able to execute the brilliance that we handed them, you know, and so you get a lot of that. And I've always believed in the idea that there shouldn't be a sales organization and a marketing organization. There should be a sales and marketing organization. And I believe that they should both basically be accountable to the same leader. They should be working on the same plan. And I've always said that marketing is sales and sales is marketing. And if you're a member of either team and you don't understand that, and I've also always gone in and from just a pure kind of tangible structural standpoint, I've gone into a couple of businesses that were really struggling. And the first thing I did, you know, and this is back in the days when where you were working, I think, was very important too, and how you were collaborating with your coworkers. One of the first things I'd often do is take the sales organization and the marketing organization and put them in the same physical space in the office. And oftentimes, you know, just completely blend them, that the collaboration between the two
Traumatizing.
happened naturally, you know, on a daily basis. But that's something I believe in deeply, is the importance of those two parts of the organization really functioning as one.
Yeah. So how did you like with the companies that you've, come in and managed or been aboard on, like how and they had those entrenched sort of this is marketing, this is sales, and they have two leaders and they do their own thing. What were some of the things that you did to help sort of change the culture so that they would realize they were all kind of on the same team instead of separate?
I think it starts from the very beginning when you're planning, when you're sitting down and you're putting plans together, bringing those teams together, and having there be an active structure and a leadership functioning process where people are just constantly collaborating and working together, all different stages. I think that it's really critical too that you create a loop. You know, you just create an endless loop of information, because sales truly is what you'd say out there on the front lines. They're talking to customers and prospects every day, and they're learning very, very valuable things from those interactions that a lot of times the members of the marketing team are not privy to, at least not on that regular basis. You've got to find a way to take that intelligence that's being gained by the marketing team and constantly feed it back from sales to marketing, and vice versa. You've got to be able to then take all the knowledge that's getting built on the marketing side with all the research that they're doing and all that they're learning about the marketplace, and share that information on a very regular basis with the sales team. And I think the best way that you can do that is, like I said, by eliminating those walls and getting them out of these silos and truly having them function as one single team with one single leader.
Wow. Yeah, that's brilliant. All right, so you're obviously very good and very passionate about healthcare tech. So at what point in your journey did the healthcare tech or just the healthcare in general start to come into your awareness and your radar?
I think it was just in me, you know, because of the way that I grew up and seeing my mother battle multiple sclerosis and being so frustrated by a disease that really didn't have any answers. So we were just constantly going from one kind of different trial treatment to another, trying this, trying that, you know, trying to find anything and everything that might help my mother, because her physical condition was just declining on a, you know, on a monthly, weekly, daily basis. And it was devastating, you know, for us to sit back and see that and to not be able to do anything about it. And during that time, you know, I would say, very frustrated with the healthcare system and how broken it seemed to me. I got very frustrated with health insurance and how difficult health insurance was to work with. And so I think it was just a matter of what my life experience had been at that point. And, those were the problems that I was keenly aware of. So naturally, those were the things that if I was going to go into business, I think
Try
it's
to
all, like I
solve
said,
that.
about solving problems. And those were the problems that I wanted to solve. My sister, younger sister, grew up with the exact same feeling that I did, the frustration, which led then to the passion, the purpose of fixing all this stuff. She was actually smart enough to become a doctor. So she spent her time hands-on helping people and trying to make a difference, fixing things. I don't think I was smart enough to get my medical degree, so I ended up fixing it more from the business
Business side.
side.
So you recently had an acquisition by UnitedHealthcare, but that was your second one. Let's talk about the first company that you built, because it was obviously in healthcare. How did that idea come about, or that opportunity come about? And then what were sort of the first several years of that business like when you were trying to build it?
Well, it's funny, we were just laughing about this with a friend of mine that I was working with on this latest venture. But I told you that the first entrepreneurial experience I had was a start around where, we took a technology company that was a product company and we turned it into a technology services company, a systems integrator development business. It started because I'd walk into our office building every day and there was a company that was in the first floor of our office building, and they were clearly growing very quickly. I could see every week it seemed like there were 10 new heads, showing up in their big open workspace. And so one day I just walked in and I said, "Hi, I'm John. I work with the business." We had the two floors above them, and I just said, "What business are you guys in? Your neighbors, it'd be good to know." And that led to a business relationship, and we became their technology partner. So that
Wow.
business was Definity Health, and they were building the first ever high deductible health plan. So they were the
Wow.
pioneers of the concept of high deductible health plans, account-based health plans, and it was all about consumer-driven health. We became their tech partner. So I became a consultant. So that first business, I was just their consulting partner. I wasn't part of the inside of that business, but helped them build that business, got to celebrate with them when they had their exit, and was really viewed as part of the team, even though I was a vendor to
In
them and a partner,
independent
not,
contractor.
not an employee. So then fast forward 20 years later, the team is coming back together. And now they're going to build what they feel is the holy grail and all the things that they weren't able to achieve with the first time around. And it was the first health plan that was truly going to achieve the goal of transparency and value-based health and simplifying the whole experience for the member and all the different things that I would say they aimed to do with the first go around, but didn't fully achieve. And this time I started out as a consultant again, and I was helping them put together the technology plan, the sales and marketing, go-to-market strategy, et cetera, as their partner. But we were about 6 months into the consulting engagement, and they said, "Hey, this time around, we want you on the team." So I joined the team as kind of part of that founding group that was going to build the business.
And what
The
was the
rest
growth
is
like on
history.
that one? Did you say you went from like six employees to over like a 7, 8 year period? Where were you at when you got acquired?
We were at about, 600, 700 employees. We just passed a million members. I think we've
Wow.
been the fastest growing health plan in the marketplace for every year since we started.
So
And we,
what makes this health plan different from what you did before, and what makes it unique in today's marketplace?
well, the whole idea with, if you think about the whole idea behind high deductible plans is that they were going to be a great vehicle for driving consumerism. And, that's the big thing that's really been lacking in healthcare all these years is there really just isn't the concept of consumerism. There isn't a marketplace per se. And because there's not a competitive marketplace, I believe that causes a lot of inefficiency and a lot of other issues. And high deductible plans, the theory was that they were going to drive consumerism because people are spending their own money. But where it didn't really follow through on the real mission is that, yes, people are spending their own money, but with that model, nobody knew what anything cost. So you can't have true full consumerism if people don't know what things cost. And furthermore, if people don't know the relative value of one thing versus another. So what we did with this latest health plan is we finally, I think, solved the Rubik's Cube of how do you give people that cost transparency? Because there have been a lot of funny agreements made between the providers and the payers in healthcare
Surely
that
this never happens in our healthcare system.
that the providers explicitly say that yes, we'll be part of your network. We'll give you discounted rates and other arrangements to be part of your network, Mr. Big Payer, insurance carrier. But if we're going to do that, you can't publish our costs. You can't tell the consumer, the members, what we're charging for our services. Essentially, what we did is we created the first ever copay only health plan that the copays were variable. So the copays were dynamic, and the copays, in essence, were reflecting what the costs are. But it wasn't just the costs, as in terms of the contracted rates, but it was the costs from a value-based point of view. We were looking at outcomes. We're looking at the quality of care as well. And between the cost of care and the quality that was being delivered, if you look at all the data to see of all these different knee surgeons that you could go to, who's delivering the best results? Whose patients are seeing the best outcomes? And then furthermore, who's charging the most value-based rates? And the balance of quality and cost is really what was the premise of how we would set the copay levels. But the whole idea was is to try to eliminate all the wasteful spending that's existed in healthcare. And the way that we did that is we just simply said, okay, if there's a certain doctor or a certain hospital clinic that is overcharging grossly for their services, or they're delivering really poor outcomes that are leading to more costs down the road, et cetera, we're just going to jack their copay way up high. And it's going to help steer our plan members away from those wasteful
What a
providers.
brilliant idea.
And the providers that are doing a good job, we're going to give them lower copays. And our members are going to understand that the lower copay is a signal of higher value care.
What
And
a
that
fantastic.
was the
Yeah.
premise.
How
And
much hate mail have you guys gotten from some of those hospitals that were overcharging?
well, yeah, it's been highly controversial for sure with the providers, but that's the good news is that the vast majority of providers are doing a great job. So the vast majority of providers think this is great. Those few that were driving the majority of the wasteful spending in the healthcare industry, they're not big fans of what we're doing at
Yeah,
all.
I was not aware of just sort of the level of that until about, I guess, about 6 years ago now. I had to have a pretty major surgery, and I had a fantastic surgeon. He'd been doing surgery for 25 years, and had great outcomes. Was not in my network, so my insurance wouldn't approve him. And so he knew that, and so he one day he, when he because I was dealing with my insurance, he finally came to me and he said, "Here's what he's like. Look. There's an independent surgery center here. I'm in Vegas." He's like, "I have privileges at the surgery center." He's like, "I've already talked to the center and the anesthesiologist." He's like, "We can get you in there. The cost of the anesthesiologist, the surgery center, and my fee be $3,000 for the surgery." And I was like, okay. And so then my insurance finally comes back and said, "Okay, hey, we can get you into this hospital. Your copay will be $1,200." And so at the time, I was like, "Yeah, it's $1,800. I'm going to go there to save some money." But I was a surgeon who'd only been doing surgery for 3 years, and I go and have the surgery, and then I got the insurance bill, and like it was $48,000. And I just remember looking at it going like, "How does this surgeon over here, who's got 25 years experience, just removes the hospital from the equation?" And I'm like, suddenly it's $45,000. And I was like, it was $45,000 in bloat. And then the funny thing was, is then my insurance came. I was like, "We're not going to approve that. We're not going to approve that. We're not going to approve that." And I ended up paying like $5,000 anyway. But that was the, I had, because I'm a fairly healthy person, that was my first experience of like being in a hospital for a day and just looking at all. I was like, "Oh my God, this is crazy." So the fact that you guys now are kind of working with that, like, that's brilliant. Now, is your plan now, is that plan in every all 50 states, or are you rolling out, or?
Yeah, it's nationwide, and it's a plan that's been adopted. We sell to employers, so we sell to employers that then provide the plan to their employees, and it's at a very large number of Fortune 500, employers at this point.
Oh, that's fantastic.
A lot
So,
of household name companies are offering Surest to their employees.
that's awesome. So, with the second run, what were the mistakes that you avoided on this the second go through that you guys may have done on the first go through?
Well, I think first and foremost, when you build a business, I think that it's good when you think about how you build your brand identity, how you build your team, everything that you do, I think should always be built with the idea that you're going to become your North Star. You are going to serve millions of members one day. So from the very beginning, when you're building the architecture for that product, it should be built with that in mind. And I think a lot of times the mistake that was made back, 20 plus years ago was that a lot of times entrepreneurs, they kind of build to meet the need of where the business is in terms of scale today, or where it's going to be in a couple quarters or a year. But ultimately, you oftentimes find yourself in a position where you've built something that can't scale. And I think, there's been a lot of studies done on a lot of businesses actually fail during the year of their greatest growth.
Wow.
And it's because they finally get to a maturity in the marketplace where they're tapping all of this demand, and yet they didn't build a product or a service that truly was ready to scale and to handle all that demand. And I think that we did a better job this time around of building the product with a framework and architecture that truly could scale to the levels that we envisioned it ultimately would. A lot of times people say it's crazy that you're thinking that you're going to have millions of members when at the time you have five, right? But you truly, I think, have to build something to accommodate that big vision that you have.
So I've worked with founders in the past. I was helping somebody with a book. They took a company from 2.5 million to 130 million. I'm just having the conversations with them where to the point that you're saying, most people think, how do we just get to $1 million? Or, but nobody really plans past like maybe 10 million. And he was talking about how when you get to 10 million, what got you to 10 million isn't going to get you to 50. And then you get to 50 and you think you got it made. It's like, but what got you to 50 isn't going to get you to 100. But a lot of it is because of the framework, because people don't know the framework to put into place to support that growth, which is, like you said, a lot of times companies will just get to a point and they just stay there. I've never heard anybody explain it that way before. That makes a lot of sense. So where are you at now? You've had a second exit. Are you going to see the transition for a couple of years? And then what's next? What's your next big, the big one you're going after?
I have another big idea that I've been working on that is kind of the last. I did a bunch of work in this industry on the provider side. More recently, I've done work on the payer side. And in our healthcare, we always talk about the triangle of the three Ps, the payer, the provider, and the patient. I have what I believe to be a kind of an amazing product idea that will really solve a lot of the problems faced by the patient that really is truly 100% patient focused and patient controlled.
Wow.
Whereas, everything I've done on the payer side, we've made life better for the patient with the health plan that we built, the businesses that I was involved in on the provider side, working with Mayo Clinic and doing different things on that side. It was always about ultimately providing a better outcome and a better experience for the patient. But I've seen just a fundamental lack of intelligence. I often say I drive a Porsche vehicle, and that vehicle, I know far more about than I know about my own body because of all the diagnostics that are built into that. And when the engine is running hot, or when the brake pads need to be replaced, or the car tells me. It doesn't only tell me, but it tells the service organization. And when I bring that car in to be serviced, they know exactly why I'm there. They know exactly what to do. It's a highly efficient and effective system that's been built between the product and the service. And the knowledge that I have at any given moment about the state of health of my vehicle is very high. And I think that with all of the mobile devices, the watches that people are wearing, the rings that people are wearing, the beds that people are sleeping on now, the diagnostic capabilities that now exist, the blood test and blood work. I mean, there's just so much data now that's
Nobody's
exploding,
using.
but nobody knows how to use it. Nobody knows what this data really means. And amazingly, when I talk to a lot of people, smart people, a lot of people don't even know what their blood type is, let alone what their cholesterol levels are, let alone, it's amazing to me how many pretty smart people, even in the healthcare industry, don't really know the fundamental things that they should about their own personal health. So my next endeavor is to take all of this data that is being created by devices, by doctor visits, by, a myriad of different, even by all the genetic things that are now swirling. But it's to take all this data and make it highly purposeful and usable for all of us.
Get Bobby Kennedy on the phone. Put this in there. We need to get going. This is a good one. So it's one of those things like when you say it, you go, yeah, like it's so common sense. Like, why do we know so much more about our cars than we do about our own bodies? And, we could go off on conversations about industries and why that's purposely been that way. But I think to your point, up until recently, we haven't had access to the data that would allow us to do that. But now we do. I mean, guy, even like the guys that have got, I see them at the gym, they have the 24-hour blood sugar monitor, perfectly healthy, but they just like, oh, I watch my blood over a month to see how my food's impacting it. I got a ring, the sleep, right? I know Oura Ring now is doing the very inexpensive blood tests, right? So yeah, but that's it. There's so much data, it never occurred to me, but how do we actually use it? How do I sync my Google Watch with my Oura Ring, with my blood sugar monitor and my genetic profile to determine that?
And ultimately, how do you make sure that that solution is just incredibly easy to
Sure.
use? The simple thing, and as a member of the team of the health plan that we just built, I don't feel that I was in a position to always execute on the principles that I've always believed in terms of keeping our sales and marketing truly functioning as one, building the product in the way that I would have wanted to build it. But at the end of the day, I've always said that it just comes down, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, but it's just, you've got to make things as valuable as possible. Whatever it is that you're providing, it's got to be valuable. But then you have to make it incredibly easy to access. If it's a product or a service, it's got to be incredibly easy for the customer to do business with it. And then I think once you've made it easy, then you also have to make it enjoyable. I mean, people are going to be drawn to something that is of value to them. They are going to continue to do business with it when it's easy and when it's enjoyable.
So how do we
And I
take
think
all of
if
my
you can
health data?
focus.
Yeah, I was saying, and how do we take all of my health data with your process, but then gamify it? So like every 30 days, I'm like, ooh, where's my character score with my own health?
Well, and I think that the answer to that, in terms of what's going to drive compliance, what's going to keep people using this, is at the end of the day, there's nothing that motivates people more than money. And the biggest thing that we have found with Surest, the health plan, is that engagement has been so high because members know that they can save a lot of money out of pocket every year by engaging with the tools and navigating to the highest value providers that they can for whatever, services, healthcare services they need. And I think that for this new idea, I think it's all going to come down to making sure that when the user engages and when the user complies and does the right things, that there's a financial benefit to them, not just a health benefit. Come up with a very novel concept about how to provide a very clear financial benefit to the user.
It's always been interesting to me that with my auto insurance, the safer driver I am, the lower rates I pay, and the more wrecks I have, the higher. But in health, it's opposite. It's like they're like, oh, the healthy people have to subsidize that. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, if you're smoking 2 packs a day, like your insurance should be triple wine. Like, why am I subsidizing your bad habit? So it's just funny that the auto industry gets it, but in healthcare, it's the opposite. I never understood that.
Well,
So.
there's some logic to it, right, Travis? I mean, my mother woke up one morning and she had multiple sclerosis. That
Sure.
had nothing to do with her genetics or her lifestyle, or it was just, as you'd say, bad luck. And that's the challenge with healthcare, is that there are people that are going to be heavy utilizers of the system and of their insurance, that there was nothing they could do
That I
to,
understand, sure.
and that's what insurance really, I think, is for. And that's why there is that idea of the balance and why the healthier people are going to be subsidizing. But like you said, people that are choosing to smoke a couple pack of cigarettes a
I
day,
got a
people that are
friend who drinks
choosing to
three
not be
liters
active,
of
people are.
regular soda a day, 3 liters of like Sunkist every single day. And I look at that going like, what? Why am I going to have to pay for your insulin? You know that's not good for you. So that's
And
what the thing that gets me about.
there's the issue right there.
Right.
And but again, it goes back to when you talk about that, at Mayo we did a lot of work in the obesity and diabetes area, and you learn very quickly that there's a big emotional and mental component to all of that.
Sure.
Mental being that there's oftentimes a lack of education. There's also oftentimes depression and mental issues that are driving certain behaviors as well. So,
Well, and then we deal with like the food. What do they call them? The food deserts. Like in some of the bigger cities, you've got miles where the only thing
yes.
there is the convenience stores, right? Versus the grocery store. So there's all of that.
Yep.
But
Yep. It's a complicated issue for
sure.
sure.
Well, good luck with it. For where we're at right now with your current company, if somebody's listening to this or reading this chapter, maybe they're running a big company and they want to explore it, how do they engage with you or the company?
Just go to surest.com, SUREST.com, and you'll learn about what is truly a revolutionary new health plan that's data-driven, technology-enabled. It's being utilized by many of today's most advanced, Fortune 500 companies as a great new benefit to give to their employees. And you can learn all the information that you want about the plan at surest.com.
Lovely. John, thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to your next venture.
Thanks, Travis.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.